This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
And Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
And this week we have three films, all from the same director, a guy called Savas D. Michael. These films are collectively known as Saints and Savages, and they are Red Rage, Righteous Villains, and Original Gangster. And we'll be talking about those in that order very shortly. Our short shot this week is by a guy called Daniel Steisen, who we've had on the show before, and it's called Gain. And our DTV throwback is Wake of Death, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme and Simon Yam. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is Red Rage. Husband and wife hitmen, Oscar and Ella Knight, are the scourge of the underworld, attacking and executing anyone who is dealing Red Devil, the drug that Oscar's younger brother got hooked on. Meanwhile, pot dealer Hugo tries to keep a grip on reality while dealing with his customers, and Riley Rose is chasing one final hit of Red Devil. Okay, as I said, this is the first installment in a sort of loosely connected group of films collectively known as Saints and Savages. I do believe, well, there's three coming out over a short period, and I believe there's at least one other in the works on its way. And you know, the films sort of share very sort of similar themes, and certain characters sort of drift in and out of each film. And Savas has got a tendency to use same actors doing different roles in each as well. So, you know, you get this sort of build-up of familiarity as you go along. I'm going to throw this over to Steve to begin with, because I'm cruel like that.
I knew you were going to. Right. It's, again, it's all over the place, to be fair. I like the aesthetic of it. I think it looks really well, but the script is just, it's, I don't know. You've got a guy who's just literally going from place to place, trying to find this drug to get one last hit. The couple who were killing all the dealers are just, it's just weird because they're just like, obviously, it's not like natural born killers where they're madly in love and they just want to fuck while they kill somebody, in a way, you know. And and then you've got this stoner sat in his flat just smoking shitloads of weed and talking to a gay cowboy. And it just didn't really make any sense whatsoever, in a way. It was overlong, meandering. And then you're throwing in like outside brothels and devil worshippers and little scroats trying to get a score of weed, and it bored me really.
Rich, this film is obviously I think, you know, the influence of things like Tarantino and the sort of films which came directly after that in its wake definitely had an influence on this film and on the Saints and Savages as a whole. How did you take this one?
Right, so it's a kind of a funny thing, because you it's hard to look at these films separately, because they all kind of much together in terms of themes and stuff. I thought it was quite interesting what you were saying there about that they're sort of designed to form a kind of collective group, like sort of with mixing up and that, because although there are similarities and things that follow through, I did view each of them as an independent film in its own right. Mm. I didn't realize that they were intended as a trilogy or anything. So that's I'm not sure if that works. I mean, I know this is the oldest one, and the thing is, I watched this one last. This was originally called Red Devil when it was made in 2019. So it's taken a fair while to get it released. As with all of these films, which are being released digitally, I think there might be some DVDs coming out, but I can't find listings for them. But they're all coming out within a few weeks. You know, by the time you're listening to this, they're possibly all out. So Red Devil, or Red Rage as it's now known, has taken quite a while to get here. So to get back on track, so I was watching them on online screeners, and this film is particularly dark. And when I'm watching films on my computer, even though my brightness settings are up, sometimes a dark film is just impossible to see. So I couldn't see a lot that was actually happening in the film, apart from when the neon lights are up and everything. But what I did see and what I was listening to, I thought was it is very Tarantino-y, kind of, it definitely got the Natural Born Killers influence going on and stuff. But I did find it quite stylish and engaging to an extent. I mean, we've got things like Steven Berkoff turning up for a long monologue. It's not the only one of these films that he'll turn up in. And there was always something entertaining happening, and I quite like the sort of the quest for this this Red Devil drug and that, and the guy playing the addict in particular, the sort of the main character one. You know, I thought it was a good performance, definitely. You know, it was really, you know, he's completely, you know, screwed up, and you know, the lengths that they'll go to get a hit and everything. I thought that was really interesting and engaging. So yeah, it's basically these deranged characters navigating this nighttime world. And although it's something we've seen before, I think it's quite interesting. But it is quite interesting. But I agree with Steve that it is a bit too long.
It certainly is, and it doesn't help when you've got these fucking monologues going on. I mean, that whole thing with Stephen Berkoff, when he's got, you know, talking about his you know, a previous life and all this sort of stuff. It just goes on forever. It really does. And I want to talk more about that sort of thing later on when we discuss Original Gangster later.
Yeah.
The characters, you know, I mean, the concept of Oscar and Ella going on this rampage because Oscar's younger brother, Billy, has got addicted to this Red Devil. And he can't find him. And, you know, out of some form of sort of revenge, he's on this rampage to get rid of the drug completely. That is a brilliant idea. That is a great concept. And there's a line in the film where one of the drug dealers basically says that this Red Devil drug, you know, it was given by the devil, and now the devil's taking it away again. You know, it's sort of like got you hooked, and now it's taken away. So it's this double sort of like agony, basically. You know, the fact that you're an addict, and now you can't get what you're addicted to. Anyway, so you know, there's this sort of interesting sort of metaphysical element to the film, because they think they're on a mission from God, basically, because Oscar had some sort of vision, and he he's basically looking for a reward from God for killing all these people in his name. You know, that sort of thing I can get with, that's fine. But then you have this stupid thing where Ella, his wife, gets really aroused when there's sort of death and destruction going on. And so basically stops mid-heist so they can fuck, which is just like, it's just so outlandishly stupid, basically. You know, Famke Janssen played Xenia Onatopp in GoldenEye, who had a similar sort of thing. You know, she got off on sort of violence and all the rest of it. At least she managed to keep her pants on within the fucking mission. You know, absolutely ridiculous. Jamie Cruz, the guy who plays Riley, the addict, and he will be popping up in our next film that we're talking about. I found his performance was so good, it was basically unwatchable. You know, he was putting so much pain and agony and a level of patheticness to the character. He was difficult to watch, which was, you know, a testament to him, basically. I'm sure there's a certain level of authenticity there. It was difficult to watch. The character.
So is that the guy playing the? That was the guy playing the drug addict, the main one.
Riley. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he was in the director's previous film to this, which was Smoking Guns, which I'll mention more probably a bit later. But he was a, he was a proper like geezer kind of character in that, and he was really good in that as well. He inhabits that those kind of roles. Very well,
I think there is stuff to like.
Baz Blackwood in this one? I can't remember, because again they bleed together. I'm not sure. Was because I like let me have a look at the cast list on this one. Baz Blackwood's in there as a priest, Father Barry Clifton.
That's right, yeah.
We've also got Ian Reddington as Hugo, who's the who's the sort of the drug dealer guy growing, you know, marijuana or whatever it is, and he's in like a room under blue light basically the whole time, and then other people are under red light, and that's it. There's lots of lighting stuff going on. This
it's aesthetically really well done.
Ian Reddington would be in, he's not recognizable in this at all, but when we see him in one of the other films, he's instantly recognizable as being well known from soap operas. EastEnders and Coronation Street and stuff, but in this, he's unrecognizable because he's under a massive furry hat and glasses and stuff.
Yeah,
but he's good. He's got playing against type and stuff. I thought he was quite good. And then there's kind of a twist ending sort of thing involving his character and stuff, which I'm not sure about, but interesting.
It was interesting, yeah. But I mean, why would that particular facet manifest itself as that, if you see what I mean, without sort of going into it. Another recurring actor in these films is a guy called Adam Deacon, who we should remember as Salam from Rogue with Meg. Who am I thinking of?
Meg. Hang on. What's the actress's name?
Megan Fox.
That's it. There we go.
We're old and doddery we are. Yes. So he's an actor who turns up in all three different films, different roles in each time. This one, he's the drug dealer who sort of, fakes out Riley, basically. I mean, you described it as an outside brothel, which I guess it supposedly is. But, you had people sort of doing twirly fire eating and all this sort of shit. I mean, really, is that shit going to go on? It's not Moulin Rouge, for God's sake. That's the thing.
The movie isn't set in a... It's not a real world setting. It's a fantasy. It's total... It's like a dream-like haze, sort of like... I guess that's supposed to be reflective of the whole drug theme, is that it's kind of a drug-fueled, ride or experience that he was trying to...
The reality is probably like a
take the viewers
fire
on.
Or something. That is what you walk past and went, "Ooh, it's a fire eater." Ooh. Anyway, yes, you're absolutely right. But it is, overall, I think this film is too long for its own good. Scenes go on too long. The whole thing with this sort of, the actress playing Ella, she reminds me of, I forgot the name of the actress in Modern Family. Sophia Vergara?
Yeah.
She reminds me of that character, basically, which is quite amusing. You can imagine Sophia Vergara telling her husband to sort of kill somebody because he looked at her funny. But there you go.
One of the other things to sort of highlight that this brings up, there's two things, actually, I want to mention. One is that it says a motion picture by
It's a bit pretentious.
But then there's also the use of music, which is very key in all the films that we're going to talk about. Yeah. But there's bits like incorporating Ave Maria in here, which I think also is another tune which turns up in in a later film. Yeah. He's got this interesting sort of grand classical music as a counterpoint. Yeah, operatic. Yeah,
something going on.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, that was it. Aria,
definitely going to be talking about the music in the next film. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so this is our intro to Saints and Savages. How did it get on? What are the scores on the doors? Starting with Steve.
I'm going to give it a 5 for this one.
5 out of 10. Okay. Yeah. Rich.
I'm going to give it a 6. I think there's enough style and derivative though some of it may be. There's enough style and interesting stuff going on that I think it is. If you're into this kind of film, this sort of fantastical gangster kind of tales, I think it is quite intriguing. It's quite an interesting film. Not necessarily always successful, but interesting.
It looks really good. I like the sound design as well. It's always does my heart good when a film production actually bothers to have proper gunshot sounds, which this does. Despite this sort of, whatever budget they had, they actually went out of their way to sort of say, no, we need proper gun sounds, which is really good. It goes on too long. As we said, some of the characterization doesn't work. But overall, I agree with you, Rich. This is a 6 out of 10. Our next film is Righteous Villains. Jeremiah is a young grifter robbing pensioners with a lottery scam. Jolie, on the other hand, is an ex-prostitute mourning the death of her husband and unborn child. These two strangers are brought together on a mission from God to rescue a child from the clutches of a satanic cult on an isolated island. That sounds a hell of a lot more interesting than what we actually get, I have to say up front. I think, in retrospect, I think we got more out of Red Rage than I would have initially thought. But this film, on the other hand, words fail me, to a certain degree. They really do. This, if we thought that Red Rage had script issues, oh boy, this... Well, Rich, I'm throwing it over to you while I collect my thoughts.
Well, the thing, I mean, it's shorter. Shortest.
Is it?
Yeah,
75
minutes.
75 minutes.
But, yeah, there's a lot of ideas, a lot of stuff being thrown around.
Mm-hmm.
There is that element of style, but it is low budget. So it's all to do with sort of angels and demons and stuff, and they're basically represented by people wearing red suits and white suits and stuff like that. And thematically there's some similar stuff to Red Rage, like the whole two killers kind of thing is kind of replayed here, but with instead of a couple who are madly in love together, it's two people who basically can't stand each other, having different motivations and stuff. It didn't work for me, and one of the thing that jumped out at me was I couldn't work out, is this a film with an agenda?
Well,
because there's some weird stuff going on with some of the statements that they make. So they say they're after the devil character, who's Adam Deacon in this, they say he's after the emasculation and feminization of men, abolition of the nuclear family, and to destroy Christianity. Mm. And this is reinforced with a thing that comes up on screen where it says that the character wants to ban gender, reduce testosterone, legalize paedophilia, post-birth abortions, eradicate faith, remove the home father from the home, and a topical one, this, help the East defeat the West by creating and spreading coronavirus. And I was trying to work out, is it satire? Is there something they really that the writer-director, Savastri Markle, really believes is a threat. You know, it's like, if you say that these things are, you know, the emasculation and feminization of men, he's really saying that like it's a really, like it's a really bad thing. And I'm like, well, I'm not, you know, I'm not sure I'm on side of that. That no. is, that, well, that is, a, that's, that seems to be quite a transphobic kind of, you know, a homophobic kind of statement.
Absolutely.
To me.
Yeah,
there's also, again, in Original Gangster, there's another scene quite like
the
that as well.
Me Too thing.
In
the graveyard. Yeah.
And like I said, I think it is a satirical notion that he's going for, but
it's so heavy handed.
Yeah. It's like, might as well slap you on the face with it.
Yeah, but you know, like saying abolition of the nuclear family, like that's, you know, like that, you know, that was sacred and it mustn't be, you know, that's such an old fashioned notion. Yeah. I mean, think of, you know, that's, I know it's supposed to be the devil sort of destroying that, but is it so bad that that thing is just, is the way they're positioning it, it's like that's the worst thing that could happen. I know, I mean, the stuff like legalized pedophilia and post-birth abortions in particular is like obviously ridiculous, but
it is ridiculous, but the thing is that's the sort of thing that the extreme right will say, that that's what's next, you know, once you legalize abortions, then this is what's going to happen next, you know, that's
yeah, like euthanasia and
exactly
like that.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a whole sequence. Go on.
It made me uncomfortable, basically, which happens quite early in the film. It's like just that kind of that notion that he was putting out there, and it was like 30 seconds of the movie. And like passes through, and that just, I had to go back over it, and I was like, hang on a minute, what are you saying here? I felt very uncomfortable with it.
I don't blame you. There's a whole bit later in the film where they come across a kangaroo court as well, and you know, there's a female judge sort of residing, and it's like, you know, sort of people sort of being sentenced to death for stuff like, I forgot what it is now, just bring me a sec.
I can't remember myself.
Yeah. So, crimes such as sexism, basically, gets you sentenced to death, you know. And as they come across it, sort of their tour guide basically says, "Oh, it's payback for years of male oppression," you know. And it's difficult to sort of see what it's obviously satire, but who is it aimed at? That's the thing. Yeah. It's weird.
Well, what I was thinking. You know, is this what woke is all about? Because I don't get the woke thing. Is this what that's about?
No, not really. I mean, this is, you know.
No, okay. I don't know what woke is, so I don't.
woke isn't a thing, basically. All that's, you know, but this is, it's either saying we're laughing at the right because this is what they think the left is, or we're laughing at the left because this is what we believe they are, you know. But it's difficult, and as you know, that bit you mentioned, it's like, well, it kind of sounds like this is like really sort of like extremist sort of right-wing politics.
There was something coming up. I'm sure I remember reading something where people were mentioning this film, and then they were relating it to the thing in America called QAnon, which again I don't know anything about.
Yeah.
Oh, you should. You really should. It's good for a laugh. It is good for a laugh.
No, you continue with the politics.
No, I was just putting it to bed, actually. So, okay. Yeah. So all we're saying all we're really saying here is, there is an attempt at very heavy-handed political satire, but it is very difficult to actually sort of see who he's actually aiming at. So, you know, the quote you had at the beginning skews it one way. The kangaroo court kind of stuff later sort of, you know, it makes you sort of go, yeah, you're joking, right? You know, you're having a laugh. You must be having a laugh. This isn't actually what you think. But who knows, you know, really, at this stage, I have no idea. Anyway, back to the film itself, Rich.
Yeah, so what I wanted to say was, so the film is advertised with three names above the title, starting on the left with Gary Doudan. Now, or Dowdan, I'm not sure I pronounced right, but basically he's barely in the film in typical sort of, you know, get somebody who's sort of a recognizable name and and they're not actually in the film very much. So he appears, he's got like one scene where he does a little bit of a, I don't know where he comes from, but he basically kills a, he takes out a pimp, and then he goes off with the girl, and then they develop a relationship, and that becomes quite significant as the story unfolds. But he's not around very much, so it's kind of, it is misleading. Mm-hmm. To sort of market this as a Gary Dudan movie compared to something like Redemption Day, which came out, you know, very recently, so people might recognize him from that. You know, that was front and center him, you know, with loads, you know, we had an ensemble around him and stuff. Yeah. But
for those who are sort of struggling to place him, this is the he was in the original cast of the original version of CSI. Played a character called Warwick in, I think he was in the first four or five series. Probably even longer, actually.
Yeah. So Savas Michael, he manages to, his budget stretched to getting, you know, fairly well known actors to come in and do bits on his on these low budget movies. So in the first one, obviously we had Steven Berkoff in particular. Berkoff's back again here doing a. Now he's doing this weird thing where he's leaning over a bed, shouting and saying, spouting all gibberish. I mean, Stephen Berkoff is like the king of gibberish, isn't he? Basically,
I did not know what was happening in that scene. I didn't know what the context was or anything. I mean, okay, at the end of the film, you finally figure out what it is, but I had no idea who was in the bed at all.
No,
you know, it just did not make any sense to me at all. Those scenes until the end. How does this film start, Rich? Remind me.
I think it starts with that, doesn't it? With Steven Berkoff and the bed.
Starts in media res.
Yes, he is.
What is it then? Remind me.
It's
the kangaroo court.
It's the bit outside where the devil and everyone is looking at a certain thing, which we won't see what it is, and everyone's sort of celebrating. It's like, okay. It's in media res. That's all we need to say, Rich. It's fucking in media res. The most overused, annoying tool in the box for scriptwriters and filmmakers, basically.
Ah, and here's another thing I have to mention. Another convention that Savas Michael seems to use in all his films is voiceover narration.
Yeah. Yes.
It was there in Red Rage. Oh. It's in this one. We'll see it in the next one. But it was also in his Smoking Gun, which I think was his first film. So if those are all his films, he tends to use that device in all of his films. And as well, in this one, going back to the actors thing, he's got Stephen Brand in this one, who we recently talked. He was in the Hellraiser.
All right.
Revelations, was it the one that was set in the house in the thing? So he appeared in that, but he's better known as the villain from the Scorpion King. So he's
that's right.
He appears in this one.
So I got a couple of things to say. Steve, you haven't had a chance to chime in on this.
No. To me, it kind of reminded me of like a Terry Pratchett novelization without the budget.
Yeah,
without the stuff. I mean, I'm not a fan of Terry Pratchett. I've tried the books, I've tried the TV adaptations, there's nothing for me whatsoever. And neither did this, to be fair. I thought, like you said, it's 75 minutes, it's too long. It's an absolute mess. All you've got is a woman and a fella going around, she's just effing this and effing that, and you cunt and all this. And it drove me insane. It really did. I just couldn't get on with it at all.
I don't blame you.
It's got this theme of religion running through everything.
Hmm.
There's, you know, even like Red Rage, you have the devil worshipping scenes and stuff like that. And this, obviously, you know, it's Battle of Good and Evil. But one thing I will say is it's a total waste of time. No, because... Right, you take them two characters out of it, you take their quest out of it.
Yep. Nothing changes.
Yep. At all.
I just
But this all kind of comes back to the point I was saying. It's kind of like what is the point? What is he trying to say with the film? I mean, it seems like it's a film that's trying to make a point, but I just don't know what it is.
I don't think he does. I really don't.
Yeah. So Jamie Crewe turns up again as Jeremiah in this one. He's the guy who played the drug addict in Red Rage, and when we meet him at the beginning of this one, he's pulling this scam of the postcode lottery, which I thought was actually, you know, it was horrific, but actually quite decently done. This shows what a scumbag he really is, this character. Yeah. Preying on these sort of pensioners and things, convincing them they've sort of won thousands of pounds just so he can break in and nick stuff. So he gets that sort of intro, and we realize that, yeah, this guy is all about the money and sort of wealth, you know, that's his motivation. Then we get this woman called Jolie, who turns up sort of shooting at people and stuff in when we first meet her. We get this lengthy sort of flashback scene, which is where Gary Durden's scenes are, basically. He plays a character called Mickey Monroe. The problem with these scenes is this is supposed to be her flashback. This is her background information. And the camera is purely focused on Gary Durden. He is...
It's all from his point of view.
Yeah. She is a secondary character in her own flashbacks, you know, which is bizarre. But you know, that gives us her motivation as to why she might go on this mission. You know, sort of the promise of being with her husband again, and you know, being the family and all the rest of it. It makes no sense whatsoever that these two people would go on this mission, especially after seeing this guy, basically. Eviscerate himself with a sacred dagger in front of them for no apparent reason. It's never explained. Nothing's explained in this film as to why he's doing this, this thing. You know,
but in the film is explained.
Yeah. So you know, we've got the thing with the crossing of the sort of kind of the River Styx with the ferryman and stuff. I thought that was all pretty good. When they get to the island, everyone knows who they are and are expecting them, and they're sort of welcomed in. This sort of cult of Satanists who they're supposed to be sort of infiltrating to, you know, steal this child away from them. And everyone knows who they are and say, hey, let's give you a tour of the island. And there's this funny scene where they sort of turn around to Jolie and go, oh, you know, and she's going, you know who I am? They go, yeah, we know who you are. And 5 minutes later, Jeremiah's going, wait, you know who I am? It's like, well, surely if they knew who she was, but he's like really shocked. It's like, what? Hang on a minute. Everything that happens from that point onwards happens at a treacle's pace. It's a really important mission that they're on, and they have to get this child out away from these people. And they just meander through this island, sort of going from one sort of, you know, tableau to the next, these sort of silly things and shenanigans which are going on. There's a whole scene which is sort of lifted from Last Orgy of the SS, which is quite interesting, quite interesting touchstone there, guys, with the baby eating, basically, the sort of feast bit. And nothing makes any sense at all, you know, really. Now, I mentioned earlier that we had Adam Deacon in the first film. He does turn up the next one as well. Now, Adam Deacon plays, you know, as an actor, he plays a type, you know, the sort of Brixton gangster kind of guy. And he does all that sort of stuff really well, I have to say. What he doesn't do particularly well is the devil. As he is here, this is the devil as realized as a Brixton gangster, and it doesn't matter how he changes voice, how deep you make it, it's still got that Brixton sort of "you get me, bruv" kind of thing to it, which is just like, which is like really bizarre.
That was pretty good.
Thank you.
it reminded me of like Jared Leto playing the Joker. you know, that kind of style.
I just
couldn't get with it. Yeah. No. The whole thing is just weird.
It really is.
Not in a good way.
Not in a good way, I have to say. It just does not work, unfortunately, this one. So let's throw it open, guys. I'm going to lead with this one. I'm giving this one a 5 out of 10. Rich?
I think an on the fence kind of 5 is kind of good for this one, because I'm not sure whether I think there's some creative stuff going in there, but yeah, it is just hampered somewhat. And whether there was originally a longer cut or something that maybe explained things a bit more, but I think the not having the money to sort of develop some of the things that they're introducing, and the whole confusing thing about, you know, the satirical nature of the film, or what it's trying to do, just sort of confounded me a bit. So yeah, I think I'm just going to go for I'm leaning towards a 4, to be honest, but I'm going to go 5.
Yeah, I mean, at best, it's a very heavy-handed satire without a focus. At worst, it's some very dodgy, toxic politics being put displayed here. Steve, on to
you. I'm going to 4 on this one. Nothing grabbed me. Like I say, there's a couple of nice shots and stuff like that, but yeah, it's just a big old mess.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So that is a 4 and 2 5s for Righteous Villains. Our final review is Original Gangster. After witnessing the execution of his parents, young Castor is saved by Milo, the very hitman sent to murder him. Left to fend for himself on the streets, Castor grows to be a violent, animalistic thug. A chance encounter with Milo brings his life full circle, and he finds his violent skills in popular demand, especially with Jean-Baptiste Philippe, the most powerful crime boss in London. Okay, so there are various themes which crop up in all of Savas D. Michael's films. We mentioned the narration for sure. There's very good sort of production design in these films, and there's some very weird casting, which we will come on to. There's also this sort of predilection for cast, characters who are like drug addicts and down and outs, which I have to admit is quite an original angle. You know, it's not something we sort of come across much in, the sort of London gangsters kind of films. So, you know, that is a sort of quite a neat angle. And we get this character of Castor in this one, played by Alex Mills, who... You know, yes, he's saved by Milo at the beginning, but then basically ditched, you know, and just left to fend for himself. And he grows into this sort of vagrant who, you know, mugging people for money and food and all the rest of it. So it's quite an interesting place to go, but it's going to go in some very strange directions. So, Steve, over to you.
Right. This is my favourite of the three. It just seemed it was a lot more grounded. Obviously, very violent, and the story. I actually thought the story was quite decent as well. The only thing that threw me, it was kind of like what was it called? A week throwback.
Yep.
When Mickey Rourke turned up.
Oh yeah.
Steve Guttenberg in this. I mean, Christ, I've not seen him on screen for donkey's years, but you know. People make choices, and then they make choices. And the choices he was making in this were... It was ridiculous, to be fair. You know what I mean?
Let's kind of set the scene for his introduction here, guys. So we get to a certain point of the film where Castor is making waves, basically. He's murdered a bunch of drug dealers, which is something I'll go back to in a minute. And he's come to the attention of this character, Jean-Baptiste Philippe, who we learn isn't Jamaican. Got to be important. You know, this isn't a Jamaican guy or anything like that. He's an American expat. So he's been living in London for donkeys. So Milo brings him to this compound in South London or somewhere. And there's armed guards everywhere. They go inside, you know, and there's like piles of ganja leaves and shit. And, you know, there's people, guns just hanging around. There's a lot of people in this compound. And they go through and there's, you know, armed guards on either side of this doorway. And the camera's sort of tracking all the way through. It's a nice long one shot edit coming, you know, following these guys through. And the camera turns a corner. And there is Steve Guttenberg sitting in a three-piece suit, drinking a cup of tea, wearing rose-tinted glasses and long hippie-style hair and a voice that sounds like Emo Phillips. And it's like, hello, I'm Jean-Baptiste Philippe. And how the director didn't go, cut, cut, for fuck's sake, Steve, be serious. Let's do this again. You know, or maybe just another time and thought, fuck it, I can't set up this shot again. Let's just go with it. I watched that and I thought, how am I supposed to deal with this? You know, how am I supposed to process this image and take it forward? Anyway, back to you, mate.
Yeah. Sorry, I was having a drink.
All right.
Yeah, up to that point, it's fine. It's a bit stretching credulity slightly, you know, that he's been living on the streets for 10 years and he just goes out, robs people and drinks booze, and it's turned him into like a psychopath, a sociopath, in a way. You know, it, violence and murder, it just doesn't faze him whatsoever. And I get it. And then you go into this compound and it's just like, what? I just couldn't take it seriously from that point onwards. And but again, I think everyone else's performance is fine. The cast is really good. Milo, he's such a bastard. Mm. And again, you could see it coming a mile off what was going to happen regarding Milo, his wife, Caster, and all that lot. You know, obvious, but. Yeah, it's good up to a point, and then that bit just throws the whole film out of whack. It really does. And I've got a feeling that it was probably earmarked for Stephen Berkoff. and they couldn't get him.
It's the wrong Steve. We sent the script to the wrong Steve. Oh, God.
And they sent Guttenberg, you know, do a Berkoff with it or some, you know, something like that. And it just... it just doesn't work from that point onwards. It really doesn't. And the ending, that pissed me right off. Right at the end. The last two shots.
Mm.
Yeah. Again, it just negates the whole bleeding film. And again, he's like, you know, he's got his voiceover going through it again. And you've got, what's he called? The guy who... The druggie from Red Rage is there again.
Oh, Deacon.
You know. Oh, I mean, either they must get on with him or he's paying the money because he's got, you know, so many from in each different film. And I thought the camera work was really good. That, you know, like you say, you got the tracking shot through the compound and even the tracking shot through the corner shop.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's the camera's in his face, but it's following him where he commits his like first murder and stuff. That was really good. And the beginning as well, I was quite shocked at the beginning.
Yeah.
It kind of reminded me of, I thought it was going to go like in Bruges kind of style. And, you know, the kid was going to die basically. But, and Milo, the guy playing Milo, he's great. He's phenomenal in it. I thought he was really, really good.
Yeah, he certainly was.
But it gets to that point and it just loses it.
Yeah.
Really does.
He reminded me a lot of Vincent Cassel from sort of French actor from things like
that. Yeah, he does actually.
Yeah. If it wasn't for his accent, you know, when he speaks talk, I thought, Because Vincent Cassell sort of learned how to speak English, you know, and drop his accent. yeah, he really, really did look familiar, sort of similar, I should say. Yeah. Mm. Okay, Rich, so, you know, Steve's pretty positive about this one. How about you?
Well, this was the first that I watched. So this was kind of setting up things. Now, the thing that has to be mentioned first is how the film is being marketed, which is with a poster of a guy, just sort of, you know, a picture of a guy, but he's got loads of weapons. You know, he's just covered in weapons. They're all over him. And he's got like a bullet strapped to him and like a couple of guns on the back. And he's got there's a couple of guns behind him and on the handles that are sticking out above his shoulders. Mm. There's like a smiley face and a sad face. And yeah, it looks like a comedy.
It looks like it's going to be something like Guns Akimbo, which I must admit I haven't seen yet, but it's you know, this sort of hyper-stylized sort of violent action movie sort of thing. Yeah. Sort of
They're promoting it with this sort of comedy poster and Steve Guttenberg's name or whatever. So you think comedy, and you see the pictures of Steve Guttenberg, you think comedy, but then the film starts and it's got that, I get, like I was saying on a previous film. So it starts with a motion picture by and sort of very serious and sort of, and a quote from Nietzsche.
Yeah. Which does not kill you makes you stronger. Yeah.
And classical music. And I'm thinking, right, so we're in Guy Ritchie territory here.
Exactly. Yeah.
But not Lock, Sock Guy Ritchie. This is Revolver Guy Ritchie. So not that that's a necessarily bad thing, because I find Revolver quite a fascinating film. But the style of it and, you know, the aesthetics that he's going for has seemed very much... Now, when after I'd watched these three, I then went back and watched Smoking Guns. Mm. That is all... that's very Lock, Stock influence, and they've even got Dexter Fletcher in the cast and that one. That's quite good, and these two act like quite a good pair together. They're very similar in a lot of ways. This one, the canvas is much wider. The other one was sort of mainly focused on a bookies, and that's a good story. And that also has that Jamie guy. Sorry,
did you say Snatch or Lock, Stock?
Well, I thought it was more like Lock, Stock, but then again, Snatch was basically Lock, Stock, wasn't it? Snatch was essentially a big budget version. But yeah, so it's quite funny to me to think, you know, it's been like, what, 20 plus years since Guy Ritchie was doing. So the whole Guy Ritchie Tarantino thing is still getting copied, you know, even now. But yeah, so that seemed a bit. You know, I was like, what am I getting into here? Okay, and it's like really serious opening. I was like, this isn't going to be a comedy, is it? It's like, so then it starts feeling, it's got that kind of Revolver and also kind of Layer Cake. I know that's Matthew Vaughn, but you know, it's kind of an offshoot. So the rise of a gangster story that's happening with this one. It's all very well worn. I wasn't so sure on the voiceover, the Alex Mills's, you know, narration. Yeah. When that kicked in, I was like, "Oh, not sure."
Well, the thing, not sure about this. I agree because he sound basically it is quite monotone, and it's almost as if it's like David Beckham reading the script, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think he is in character, you know, because Caster is this sort of very. You know, we said he's you know, from his emotions and things, he's very much shut down. And, you know, he's a very sort of stoic sort of character. He's quite nihilistic. Yeah. He doesn't seem to care if he lives or dies, really. It's just what happens. And that sort of really comes across in the voiceovers as well.
No, so that, yeah, so his character and that was fine. I thought it was quite interesting. And then obviously Milo, the serial killer, because this is what made me think of Revolver, because you know in Revolver there's the bit with the killer bloke who's wandering around and he decides not to kill his target, he instead kills the other, I think it's like Stanley Tucci or something, if I recall correctly. I might be completely misremembering the film, but
I don't think I've seen Revolver. I'm getting, I think I've skipped that one. What's the one with Gerald Butler?
Oh, that's Rock and Roller.
Rock and Roller. I skipped Revolver, I must admit. I'll have to watch it at some point.
Yeah, you should check it out. I mean, stylistically, it's interesting, but it's like you won't follow what's going on at all. Yeah, it just kind of ends. It's weird. But anyway, so Ian Reddington from who was the guy growing the drugs and stuff, who I said was unrecognizable in Red Rage. He's Milo here, very much recognizable as the guy who was in Coronation Street and EastEnders, obviously done lots of other stuff. He's really good. But what I liked about what they did with his character was he saves the boy as this like little bit of potential sort of redemption for himself. But then he abandons the child.
Yeah.
And when they're reunited later, he is probably the worst father figure. Caster could probably have. And he doesn't make any, you know, he's not affectionate to him. He's kind of like, he saved his life. He's done his bit. That's it. And he's just going to go back to being like the worst human being in the world. Yeah. And again, this was kind of played into the second film because I wasn't quite sure to an extent about the film's gender politics.
The bit in the cemetery.
And even at home when the way he was treating his wife, and I was like, is the film kind of condoning that behavior to an extent? I mean, I know by the end of it, it isn't, but I was a bit uncertain for a while there. But I thought that was quite interesting that they, you know, the way they play with that dynamic and Caster not really, you know, intervening to kind of step on the toes, you know, to get involved with he's got sort of keeping out of it in a part of a way. He's just not really connected. He doesn't realize that maybe he should or anything.
Exactly, so. The thing is that, you know, it must be sort of relatively confusing for him as a character because, you know, he's put Milo on this sort of pedestal, you know, the guy who saved his life sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then sort of trying to reconcile his other actions with that action. It's kind of weird. Yeah. That's an interesting twist.
Yeah, the other thing was that they sort of really drive home the difficult, you know, the difficulties of Caster's childhood, you know. So not only has his family's been killed, but then like a guy comes up, he's like, "Oh, hello, little boy. Oh, do you need some help? And it's like, oh, come on. Leading that. I mean, it doesn't go into a terrible situation or anything, but it's kind of hinting at it. The way he's just he's a victim, he's vulnerable, and it's that whole the victim becomes the bully kind of thing, where he becomes worse than the people who have been bad to him because of how much he's just become desensitized to it and had to survive and stuff. So I think there's some interesting stuff going on here, which is different to the usual kind of gangster movie formula, of which this is very much following in. But then they go and Steve Guttenberg comes in. So getting back to Steve Guttenberg again, who's basically in a completely different film. And that's when it sort of really kicks off into the sort of layer cake-ish sort of typical Guy Ritchie fashion, in which you meet larger than life characters.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind it. I didn't dislike it, but I did think that it was, as Steve said, he's made some choices there, and they are his choices. But I think, you know, at the very least, you say this has got Steve Guttenberg noticed, and he's doing a lot he's been very active in promoting the film and everything. You know, it's kind of a big deal for the film to have him involved, because, you know, he's created this character that's got caught people's eye, and he's getting press about it and stuff for good or bad, you know, you could say. But that is a feature. It's kind of a key feature, but it's from a different movie. Is the sort of weird nature of it. There aren't lots of other larger than life characters in the movie. They're all quite gritty characters.
It is,
and he's kind of the only one that's a bit loopy. Maybe you're right. Maybe it was supposed to be a Stephen Burkoff, because it is kind of that kind of.
My issue with the character, I mean, it is one of those things when you that first introduction, it's like being hit with a brick, you know, because he just like stopped dead, going, my mind doesn't know how to process this within the scope of this film. But he sort of grew on me after that. You know, there's a couple of scenes where he actually sort of gets relatively serious. I think it's one where Caster reports back to him and he explains what happened with Milo. And, you know, that was actually quite, there's a bit of pathos to the scene and actually quite at work. But a lot of his scenes, he's sort of playing it like in this sort of sing-song voice. Nothing's really serious. It's all a bit of a laugh sort of thing. You know, basically because I'm surrounded by an army of thugs who no one can touch. But it just feels weird, you know, that you'd have this sort of like la 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 kind of sort of like approach to it. You know, it's kind of like the way there's in the trailer for Justice League, Batman versus Superman, when you first meet Lex Luthor, played by who played him?
Jesse Eisenberg.
Jesse Eisenberg, yeah. And he's doing this sort of weird sort of sing-song voice going, oh my God, Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent meeting for the first time. Whoa. You know, it's that sort of thing and I fucking hated it. You know, I wish he'd been a bit more serious with it, basically. He's still dressed like a loon, but, you know, he could have played a bit straighter, I think. So he did sort of grow on me a bit. Anyway, but the bit I want to talk about in this film is relatively early on, Caster is given a kilo of cocaine by Milo to go and sell. He hasn't got a fucking clue how to do it. So basically, he just turns up to a drug dealer and goes, would you like to buy my brick of cocaine for $38,000, you know, or pounds or whatever? And you get this monologue again. You know, it's something that this guy really loves is his monologues. So we get this drug dealer given this monologue. And, I'm thinking, Is this a job requirement for drug dealers to have a story that they can bring out at any time and use as a metaphor for anything? You know, how many times has this guy stood in front of a mirror and done this talk, you know, to get the right expression, you know, to get the right pause in the story to try and give it a bit more menace, you know? Unfortunately, it felt like the most cliched moment of the film, you know. It drew me out of the film for a little bit. Where I'm thinking,
this is Tarantino and Ritchie's influence, you see. They've set this in motion.
Yeah, and I think that's where it's, you know, it's really wearing its influences on its sleeve, in that regard. The only other thing is that we get one of these moments at the end, which is sort of like, oh, you know, the circle of life thing, you know, things are coming back to bite you, that which was set up at the beginning, but it didn't work because this guy turns up and he's like, remember me? And I'm like, no, not really. Who are you? You know, and it wasn't until this guy had driven off again, I'm going, oh yeah, you know, I can kind of imagine Caster doing the same. It's like, because he's not seen this guy for like probably a year, you know, however long passes in time for this film, you know, because he spends a long time in the compound and that, and then sort of getting together with Milo's wife and everything. So, you know, a good few months have passed and suddenly this guy turns up in a taxi and goes, remember me? And Caster would be going, no, I don't think so. I'm not very good with faces, mate. Sorry. Yeah. But anyway. But I think you're right, Steve.
I did recognise it, but I thought it was a bit, you know, it was kind of a bit, that's convenient to the story.
He would so-called karma and all that sort of box. But this is certainly a more polished film than the others, that's for sure. I think he's certainly, you know, there's definitely improvements here. There's still room for improvement, for sure. Some good sort of gunplay going on, you know, some brutal executions, again, some good sound effects, which make it sound a lot more expensive than it probably is. I think it's always worth spending a bit more money in that department. Something that Ross Boyas will definitely attest to, you know, get some decent gun sound effects in your film, otherwise pop doesn't really work. Okay, scores on the doors, unless there's anything else to talk about on this one.
No, apart really. From just the sort of wrap up comments on the score, I'd say.
All right. Well, yeah, I'm giving this one a 7 out of 10. Rich,
I was going to say 6, but I suppose I'll go a 7 as well. I do think that it is a bit too pretentious for its own good.
Yeah.
But if you get past that, then there is there's a decent story here. Fans of British gangster movie, you know, people who watch like Nemesis recently, I think would enjoy it.
I think they'd get a lot out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they would. I think there's a lot to enjoy here, but you do have to kind of get through that. His propensity for sort of like grand operatic arias and stuff. It's just
The soundtrack. I mean, you know, the soundtrack is very in your face, isn't it? You know, to coin a phrase.
I mean, this is an hour and 50 minute. It's an hour and 50 minute movie.
Yes,
it didn't have to be an hour and 50 minutes. You know, they didn't have to have that pace. It could have been trimmed down, made a bit more fast paced, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, 7. Okay.
Cool. Yeah. And Steve?
Yeah, I'll go 7 on this one. Like I say, I thought it was the most enjoyable out of the three.
Awesome. So 3 7s for Original Gangster. Now, before we wrap up on this section, I just want to sort of see if anyone's got any thoughts about the... I mean, you know, we've had to sort of crush these three films in the space of a week, which is quite heavy going. You know, let's face it. For one director, sort of get used to his style and stuff. So, I mean, as a sort of collective, I mean, whether or not they are meant to be a collective or whatever, has anyone got any sort of final thoughts on the films as a whole?
Don't bother with the first two.
Oh no, I disagree. Even though I think people should watch Righteous Villains. I we had to, so everyone else has to. But I think there is entertainment value to be had from it if you're in the right frame of mind, and the right quantity of alcohol. I think you could have a bit of a laugh at its expense, you know, and it will generate a lot of conversation. I think it's probably not what it was designed for, but I think that is there, and I think Red Rage, you know, for its faults, there is some interesting metaphysical sort of themes running through that film, but you know, neither film really works as entertainment for its own sake, whereas Original Gangster, I think, does. Even though it's a stupid name for the film and a dreadful poster.
Yeah, it's a stupid. I think it's been interesting having this crash course of films by Savas D. Michael, because I wasn't familiar with him prior to this. I find it interesting that it's come to the point where he's had to set up his own distribution company to release them all finally himself, rather than, I mean, I presume that they haven't been available previously. So Red Devil being the first of them from 2019. So which means the last film, the film he made prior to those, which was his first film, Smoking Guns, was the only one available until now, basically, as far as I'm aware. And I think you view those films collectively, and I think what we've got here is a very passionate, very interesting, very influenced British filmmaker, you know, is doing it, not necessarily always successfully, but doing very interesting things with conventions and, you know, things we're familiar with, and, you know, some good British actors, and obviously imported actors as well. So he's definitely someone I'm interested in, and I will watch the future films that he makes, because as I say Smoking Guns I think is a good little film. And I think Original Gangsters works well with it. The other two are much more experimental. Red Rage. I don't think that's a good title. Red Devil is what it was originally called. It's a much better title. The that is probably is certainly the more interesting and more coherent of the two experimental ones. But I, like you, I think, yeah, there is some merit in checking out Righteous Villains, even if it just acts as a talking point or something. His next film is, I believe, going to be The Bizonians with Vinnie Jones,
yeah.
And also Marina Sirtis. Mm. So that should be interesting. Hell. And after that, he's got another one lined up,
yeah.
Also with Marina Sirtis and Stephen Burkoff again, called The Phantom Warrior, which apparently has also got Dean Cain.
Yeah.
That's in, apparently, according to IMDb, that's in post-production. And it's the origin story of a masked vigilante, an immortal soul, Nemesis Knight. So sounds like a comic booky kind of, well, comic
book, Phantom of the Opera kind of thing. Well, the thing is, Oscar and Ella were called Knight. You know, that was their surname. So,
oh, okay.
So,
oh, yeah.
You know, it could, be,
it could be a time.
Yeah, it could be going full circle. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. You know. So, and Vaz Blackwood is in this film. Adam Deacon apparently is going to be in this next one as well. But Vaz Blackwood was in Original Gangster. I think he was in Guy Ritchie as well, wasn't he?
He was in Lockstock.
Yeah, so I like Vaz Blackwood. I always like seeing him turn up in stuff. So it was nice seeing him. I liked seeing Steve Guttenberg again. Like you, I haven't seen him in anything for quite a while.
Although, he had a very small cameo in a film called Trauma Center with Bruce Willis recently. But it was like one scene, but never mind. But yeah, I he grew on me in this one. He really did. So, yeah. Cool. So that is the Saints and Savages films. Check them out. They're all available, or they will all be available online very soon. Our short shot this week is Gain. Daniel Stuyzen plays a bodybuilder who is obsessed with gaining muscle at the cost of his relationship with his girlfriend. Unfortunately, guys, I didn't get a chance to watch this properly, so I'm going to throw it over to Rich to begin with.
Now, we've spoken with Daniel Stuyzen in the past, and he is a bodybuilder in real life, and he's been trying to develop his own productions. So he when we spoke to him, he'd made a film called Retribution, where he was playing a homeless man who I think he ends up rescuing someone. It was kind of trying to use it as a springboard to like a proof concept thing. That doesn't seem to have happened. But it seems around the same time, he was working with the same director, Nick Wall, to make this film. Because I think this was, say, shot around a similar time. But over the time, it's only just now coming out. It's come out in February. It was released by, directed by Nick Wall. It's a very different kind of film to Retribution, but in a lot of ways, very similar. So whereas with bodybuilders and movies, you often get the positive side, the big, the Rock kind of stuff, the big heroic characters. Stuyzen doesn't seem to be interested in doing that. He wants to play damaged characters, which I think is quite an interesting way to go with it. I mean, Retribution was a bit action-y, but Gain is a very serious drama and something a bit different to what we would, what we've seen, a lot of the sort of short films that we've seen lately, especially from people involved in the action film world. Stuyzen is a stuntman and stuff. He's worked on various, superhero movies and stuff. And this one, he's really willing to lay it bare, literally. I was quite impressed with, his courage and, he's not shy about, I mean, obviously he's a bodybuilder, so he's not shy about his body, but he shows he gets naked in the film, and he's showing himself as somebody who's very insecure, and desperate to look good for social media and stuff, and really trying to measure up. There was a documentary called Bigger, Stronger, Faster a few years ago, which was all about these guys who pack themselves into gyms and stuff because they want to be the next Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, all these people who were inspired by, and they live in the vans and stuff, and they, a lot of them don't make it. And that's one of, that's what this story is. It's the story of one of those guys who doesn't make it, and the costs of that. And although I don't think Sisson's a fantastic actor, you know, so I think the film itself is very interesting, very good. And he, you know, I cannot fault, you know, him, what he's done with the film, and, you know, presenting this very dark view of, you know, bodybuilding and steroids and, you know, say impact on relationships and stuff. So, yeah, I think it's not a great film, but very interesting. It's 25 minutes long. If you're interested in dramas and bodybuilding and stuff, I think it's definitely worth a look. Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, it's not the best performance in the world, and it is very, very grim. But it's, you know, it's about obsession and addiction to me, and it goes to some really dark places. And you know, the character himself is so obsessed and so, you know, with what he wants to be, and he's a bit of a dick, to be fair.
Yeah. Oh, he's totally. He's not a nice guy.
Yeah.
No. I was wondering why she was even with him, to be honest.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, she turns around, she says, "Well, I'm not really happy," and he says, "You know, I think we've got a good relationship. We talk, we eat together, we have sex. That's a good relationship." And it's like, mate, no, it isn't. It really isn't. You need to sort yourself out. And expect, you know, the final shot just shows how self-obsessed and how, you know, addicted to doing the bodybuilding. He doesn't care about anything else. It's just him, you know, doing what he's got to do and sod anybody else. And I think that's, like I say, that's shown in what happens in the final shot right at the very end. And yeah, it's not all about the glamorous side of bodybuilding and stuff. And this does show that deep emotional hole that people can get into. And it was actually quite interesting.
Yeah, there was a film recently with Craig Fairbrass called Muscle, which I haven't seen, but I presume this might work, you know, if people are interested in that film and they enjoy that film, that this might be an interesting film to watch with it, or, you know, sort of a related kind of theme, because that's another, as far as I know, it's another film that's quite a serious drama set against that world.
Yeah.
Did you get to watch any of it, Mike?
Just a little bit. So I sort of watched the beginning and the end, basically. So that, yeah, the harrowing moment at the end was. And I have to admit, you know, the actual makeup effects they did for that scene were really good. And made it very uncomfortable to watch.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, as you say, you know, he, from what I've seen of Daniel Stiles and stuff, as you say, he's been involved in some of the sort of superhero stuff as sort of extras and, you know, some minor cast characters. He did turn up in Justice League for a brief scene, I think in the the Age of Man.
Snyder Cut.
Yeah. The Snyder Cut, basically. So, but yeah, as you say, he's more interested in sort of developing these sort of darker characters, sort of, you know, less clean cut sort of people, which is very interesting, very, very commendable.
He's got I think it's a feature that's apparently on the way called Last Man Down, which has got a really cool looking poster on IMDb. It's a sort of a post-apocalyptic kind of story. I'll be interested in which it would be, I believe, his first proper lead. It's also got Natasha Malther in it from Blood Rain. And I don't know the director's work or whatever, but yeah, it'll be interesting to see what he does when he makes this transition to a leading role. I think I'm not sure, you know, he does in both the films that he's done previously in terms of his productions, the short films, he's had this really big beard. which marks him out as quite distinctive. I'm hoping that he loses the beard for the next role. I mean, because I think we've kind of seen that side of him already. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of rough look. I'd like to see, you know, him transform himself into a completely new character, not necessarily heroic one, because I think playing anti-heroes or something, or damaged characters, is still quite an interesting way to go. But yeah, he's from was he from Sweden originally? Is he Norwegian? I can't remember.
I think he's Norwegian.
Yeah. So he's he's definitely an interesting guy. And there's some, if anybody's, you know, interested to sort of find out a bit more about him, he's done, we did an interview with him, but there's other, you know, interviews that you can find around on the net, or you know, talking about some of the stuff that he's passionate about and that stuff. So yeah, including gain and, you know, the darker side of bodybuilding that it's portraying and stuff. So yeah, I think he's definitely one to watch.
Yeah, well, it's obviously, you know, a subject close to home. Mm. We will put the short shot onto the footnotes, as we usually do, so you have a chance to check it out. It is 25 minutes long, or just short of 26 minutes. Check it out. Our DTV throwback this week is Wake of Death. Jean-Claude Van Damme plays Ben Archer, a nightclub bouncer, 1 week from retirement when his wife is brutally murdered for trying to help a young runaway fleeing from her triad boss father. Calling in some favors from loyal friends and family members, Ben is going to make them pay in blood. This is a first-time watch for me. It's being re-released on Blu-ray, I believe. Well, probably being released on Blu-ray for the first time.
Yes, it's the first Blu-ray release.
First Blu-ray release.
Kaleidoscope.
So I'm kind of on the fence with this one, believe it or not. I really
What did it start with, Mike?
It does start with fucking in media res. So you're right. Right from the start, I'm not in a good place with this one. But even so, when it settles down, there's a lot to like here, but it does take a while for it to sort of settle down. The editing style, I was not impressed with at all. It was all choppy. Talking about in media res, that car chase, which we have at the beginning and then sort of features about two thirds of the way into the film. It is edited worse than the opening of Quantum of Solace. That's how bad that scene is. You know, it makes Quantum of Solace look lucid. I was not on board with that at all. In fact, I didn't realize at first that the two kids were in separate cars. Because of the way it was edited, it just was not clear. You know, I'm thinking he's pulled the girl out from the car. What about the other guy? The other kid is still in there, surely. But anyway, that's what made this film work is the violence. This film is wonderfully violent. It really is, and there's a brilliant scene. One thing this film does really well is marry up really quiet, introspective moments with loud, bombastic violence happening straight afterwards. So there's a scene where Ben Archer's at home. Trying to come to grips with the fact that his wife's been murdered and that, and he's really morose. And all of a sudden, this guy comes through the window with a samurai sword, sort of, you know, chopping at him. And it is just so sudden and so, you know, shocking. It's just a brilliant sort of cinematic moment, and it works really well. So you know, you do get these sort of flashes of brilliance all the way through the film, which I really enjoyed. Steve, how about you?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with you. Some of it's great, some of it's a bit ropey. The violence is quite shocking, to be fair. Mm. Especially like the brothel scene and
That torture scene.
The torture scene, that's what I was just going to get to.
The torture scene, you know, I tell you what it reminded me of. I remember watching Casino, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a bit where Joe Pesci's got this guy's head in a vice, and he's tightening it and tightening it, and he tightens it so much this guy's eyeball pops out, you know. Yeah. And I remember, you know, as people I knew at the time watching it going, Jesus, Vinny, calm down. Yeah, just take a breath.
Yeah.
But this is like even more intense than that. You know, it was seriously intense and bloodthirsty and nasty.
Mm.
Yeah. So points for that. Short.
Yeah, but it's your typical like mid-90s revenge thriller. You know, there's nothing new here at all. But it does well. Some of it's a bit ropey. Like you say, the car chase is, it's edited in his life. And also the motorbike chase as well.
Mm.
Through the mall. I thought that was a bit over the top, really, to be fair, some of it. And then I just thought the ending was a bit sudden. You know, they attack him and his brother attack the boat and it's all going off then it's done. And it's one that, does he live, does he die? Mm-hmm. He probably does live, but it's not really confirmed, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's it. Done, dusted. Yeah. Happy Basically. Days, you know, crack on.
Yeah. Rich, I'm assuming you'd seen this one before, so this is a revisit for you.
Yeah, I actually had it on DVD from when it was released in 2004. So I've got the old Fight Factory Sony DVD release. This version, although it's come out on Blu-ray, isn't any different as far as I'm aware. So it's even got the same featurette as the extra feature. That's basically the only thing. There's some packaging extras, but they haven't. It's not like an extended version of the film or anything like that.
Is this not an 88 Films release?
It's Kaleidoscope.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, 88 Films have done several Jean-Claude Van Damme ones, including Legionnaire. But there seems to be a trend now developing with other distributors going, well, actually, maybe we should get in on the John JCVD action. Yeah. And so, Wake of Death. I find it it's similar to how I was feeling about Savasty Michael's films, is that it seems quite pretentious at times. I don't like some of the weightiness that they're trying to go for. It's trying to be quite somber and melodramatic, but at the same time it's insubstantial. It's all like style over substance for me. And it also, that's the warning sign is there at the beginning. So you've got an opening, which is a quiet sequence, basically a pullback shot of Jean-Claude Van Damme and a couple of dead bodies. And then intercuts to the action scene, the sort of flash forward or whatever it's supposed to be. And it moves back. And then we've got this interminable opening credits sequence, which is a Simon Yam love scene, which is completely not needed at all. And I was just like, we can get that over with. Come on.
So,
go on.
No, I mean, I as you know, I'm a big fan of Simon Yam, but in that case, less is more.
He's not actually got that much to do in this movie.
No, that's right.
He's not a very good villain. And why? Okay,
no.
If this is apparently his daughter, although she doesn't know this because he gets told at the beginning and kills the, which is again is all slow motion and whatnot.
Yeah.
She keeps getting away from him. Mm-mm. It's like he's got her, and then they're like, she managed to get on this boat or whatever, and now she's gone to America, and then they get her again, and then we've actually lost her again. They don't show her actually getting away, but somehow she keeps managing to get away. Anyway, so I think there's a couple of things going on here. Van Damme's got a really great character to work with here, and he throws himself into the performance. He really, this is Van Damme developing his acting, and it's really, and I think it's really good. He doesn't get as many scenes as perhaps I think he should have, whether that's contractual or something, I don't know. But the film keeps throwing over to supporting characters, like, you know, they set up this torture scene, and he goes. And we're left with these other characters to do it. we don't really spend any other time with these characters apart from this lengthy torture scene, which again would probably be, you know, got rid of. It's not really necessary. Well,
those guys are dead in the next scene, you know.
The film, say, it's got that style and whatever, which I don't like. I do like the dramatic scenes with Van Damme, although I don't think there's enough of them. And some of them don't work, like he meets the girl and he gives her the moose and stuff like that. I think that was his choice because that's mentioned in the making of feature. They were talking about how to do that scene and stuff, and they decided to go for the no dialogue approach. I don't think that works, but the other thing is the action. There is some really good action.
Yep.
As with most of the film, you've mentioned it already, Mike, the editing, just completely, I hate all the editing, over-stylized cuts and whatever. It's completely not necessary. They managed to do a chase scene with a tanker truck and an explosion.
Yeah.
When we watch stuff nowadays, we don't get that. You know, we saw it when we watched Steel.
PM Entertainment level of...
It is, to an extent, yeah. But we don't, in action movies now, we don't actually see a lot of practical vehicular action and explosions. It's mostly gunfights and stuff these days. But so that was quite refreshing. I quite liked some of that. And the scene that Steve mentioned where the motorcycles are going through the mall. Wow, that's a hell of a sequence. Might be a bit over edited and stuff, but big sequence. I mean, there's some really nice stunt work in that. I mean, the driving through the windows and the bike doing a jump and actually going over one of the mid levels and coming down the other side or something. It's really great, and it ends with a fight between Van Damme and Arnold Chon, who's really good, very talented action guy. At the end of the movie, so we got Tony Shiena as a supporting character. He gets to have a fight with Philip Tan.
Yeah, the knife fight was really good. Yeah,
that's a great knife fight. And although it's got the most stupid ending, where Philip Tan died from being in the crotch.
Yeah,
didn't know that was a fatal move. I mean, a shocking might put him into the shock, but I don't think he'd be dead. But
it's also that it's more the help that it does when it happens as well.
Yeah.
The little girl, I thought she was fine.
Yeah.
One of my favourite things, I mean, the film that comes to mind, now, it's a film that I haven't seen for a very long time, so I might be misremembering it, but in this film's tone and style, it made me think a lot of Crying Freeman Mark Dacascos, which is another kind of slow burn, tortured soul, stylized action film. I'd like to see it again. At some point, if I could, but I wasn't a fan of it then. It's not that kind of, not the kind of one that I like. But the just to sort of round out my comments, one of my favourite. This was one thing. There was a quote. There was a line that the Van Damme gives, and I'm pretty sure he got it wrong, but they didn't want to tell him, or they didn't realise, because his wife, the whole reason that his wife gets killed is because she brings Simon Yam's daughter home. And he says to his wife, so you brought your homework, huh?
Yeah.
Instead of saying, so you brought your work home. It's like, well, that's obviously wrong, but did they not want to tell him? So anyway, but the other, what I do like about this film is that Bert Kwok's in it. But he has nothing to do. He's like in it for like a second. He was in Kiss of the Dragon around the same time. He had more to do in that. But so to see Bert Kwok in a serious action movie, even in any role, was quite a treat. I mean, obviously we lost him now, but for so long he was always just a comedy guy, and for the most of his career he pretty much was, whether it was playing Kato to Peter Sellers or Harry Hill's sidekick or Last of the Summer Wine or whatever, he was always associated with comedy. So to see him in a dark, brooding action movie is quite refreshing. So I like that. I mean, I've always had a fondness for Bert Kwok. It's a film with a good performance, but and a couple of good bits of action, but I'm personally not very fond of it at all, to be honest.
I must admit, I'm planning to buy the Blu-ray. I think the action scenes work really well. Basically, the action scenes come across like it's almost John Woo if John Woo had the worst editor in the world.
Well, it was supposed to be, the original director was Ringo Lam.
Ah, right. Yeah,
and I'm not sure at what point. I don't know how much of the footage Ringo Lam actually shot before he left the project. I'd like to think it was the action sequences.
Yeah, he'd like to, especially the brothel scene. The brothel scene was really well done. Really enjoyed that. So, yeah, As I said, I think there's enough interesting stuff going on. You know, the fact that he's relying on his brother and in the cop and things like that going on gives it an interesting element. I like that side of it. The fact that he can sort of rely on these sort of loyalties and things, just in his sort of quest for vengeance. So, I think this is due out in July. Is that right? June or July?
No, it's out.
Is it?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I didn't realize. Yeah. Okay. In that case,
I'm pretty sure it's already out. It came out at the start of April.
All right. Well, it's on my watch list, on my shopping list, I should say. Any other comments for Wake of Death before we wrap up?
No, I'd say no. Just basically see it for Van Damme, see it for his performance and a couple of really cool action scenes. Don't go in expecting a great showdown with Simon Yam. All the Simon Yam stuff, unfortunately, is a bit of a damp squib. But has a good fight with Philip Tan. So there's some good action in here.
You got the obligatory Van Damme arse shot as well.
Yeah, there is a bit of that. but yeah, this is pretty solid, I thought, overall. This is a first watch for me. I must admit, when Van Damme sort of switched to DTV, I didn't see a lot of his films. So things like The Order and Derailed? I think it's another one of his. I haven't seen any of those from that period. So this is the first one. So,
really? You should definitely watch The Order.
Yeah.
I mean, Derailed is terrible, although it's got some, I don't know, there's some interesting things in there, but it's really, really rough. Then there's stuff like Second in Command, which is just so bland that you even forget it completely. It's just like not memorable at all.
Didn't even know Van Damme was in that one. I thought that was a Mark Dacascos one. But I saw Double Team at the cinema and I had Knock Off on Laserdisc when Laserdisc was knocking around. I think those are probably the latest ones of his that I saw until recently.
Apart from Universal Soldier.
Sort of recent ones, yeah. So there seems to be...
You loved Kill 'Em All, didn't you?
I hated Kill 'Em All.
Kill 'Em All, awful.
No, that was awful. But Enemies Closer, I do enjoy. Yeah, so that's one to have a look at. There's that one we kind of did with Dolph Lundgren, where they end up on the biggest submarine in the world. Yeah.
Blackwater.
Yeah, that's pretty awful.
six Bullets you might like as well.
All right.
That's 2012. So that's just sort of on the back of some of the other ones. And The Shepherd, if you haven't seen The Shepherd.
Oh, I have seen The Shepherd, yeah.
And Until Death. That's quite good.
No, I haven't seen that one. Yeah. No, The Shepherd I've seen, obviously, because it's Isaac Florentine and Scott Atkins in there. So, yeah. But yeah, there seems to be a bit of a gap. But maybe The Order I'll have to check out. So that wraps up our show for this week. Thanks for Rich and Steve for looking at the Saints and Savages collective, shall we call them. I think we gave it quite a decent sort of colourful commentary overall. So thanks for that, guys. That came out really well. Check out Daniel Stuyzen's film Gain. It will be in the footnotes, and the trailers for the other films will be there as well. Other than that, you can check out our Facebook and Twitter pages for the DTV chart and other new release information. And also our Short Shots podcast has now got its own Twitter page as well. What's it called again?
DTV Short Shots. If you look that up, we're just posting recommendations every day at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, so each day we'll be recommending a short film for you to check out. So thank you for listening and tune in again next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.